The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I don't know if Ross O'Carroll, Carol Kelly's father, is quite the correct way to portray him. Progenitor, stepdad, something along those lines. Paul Howard is with us. Before he reached the heights of multimillionaire status through the success of the Ross O'Carroll Kelly books, he was, of course, an award-winning sports writer. Undoubtedly a happy day for you, Paul, to see that David Beckham is getting the knighthood.
Yeah. I mean, I've campaigned for it for the last 30 years or so, you know, as a Liverpool fan, you know. I'm absolutely delighted for him.
Now, we should at some point talk about how life is after Ross, although he's still around, just in newspaper form rather than in book form. Before that, I want to talk to you, if you don't mind, about something probably less happy and fun, which is Humphrey.
Yes.
You wrote this absolutely gorgeous piece about your dog, Humphrey. Basset Hound?
He was a Basset Hound, yeah.
You had him for how long?
13 and a half years. And he was the first dog I ever got, the only dog I ever had. And he died last year. I mean, he had a great life. He had a long life for a Basset Hound. He was my constant companion. He went everywhere with me. You know, he was, you know, I work from home, so he was at work with me all day. He used to sit under my desk. My life was totally attuned to the rhythms of his day and his to my day. So we kind of, you know, he wanted his lunch at 12 and I wanted mine at 1, and we sort of found a compromise, which was half 12. And he was a brilliant dog. And I remember I'd be working, and quite often I'd be too busy to play with him if I was up against a deadline. And that always upset me, because I would look down and he would have made sort of 7 or 8 attempts, which I wouldn't have even noticed, 7 or 8 attempts to try to goad me into playing by bringing me toys. And they'd all be beside the desk. But the toys were always the ones that he thought I had a preference for. They were never his favourites. I bought him this kind of range of Star Wars toys because I'm Star Wars mad. So there was a Chewbacca, cuddly Chewbacca, and a Luke Skywalker and a Yoda. And he would bring them to me because he thought they were the ones I liked. So he was incredibly smart, incredibly intuitive. And he was such a great dog, you know. So that piece touched a lot of people, and I know it did. Like, I still have people, probably more than anything I've ever written in my writing career, that piece touched more people than anything else, because, you know, if you've loved an animal, you know what it is to lose an animal. You know, any pet, not just a dog, but I think it just struck a particular chord with dog lovers.
It's odd that the fact that you know that the period is likely to be, I mean, as you say, 13 years is what we would say a good innings.
Yeah.
Doesn't make it any easier.
No, it doesn't. In fact, it's worse, because you have a bond in that time. And like I said, you have a rhythm to your day, which is determined by, you know, the needs and demands of a dog. And we just got to know each other's personalities so well. And the place just felt so empty after he was gone. So, I mean, his ashes are still, his ashes are still at home. You know, we have the ashes, and a friend of ours bought us a lovely rainbow, which we put on top of the box that contains his ashes. There's a picture of him beside it, like, you know, and I still, you know, people think this is utterly ludicrous. At night when I go to bed, I still say goodnight, Humphrey, like I did every night when he was alive. He was such a great dog.
I don't know if you found it, but when my dog died, I became immediately struck by all of the accoutrements that the dog had that were so previously filled with life.
Yeah.
You know, so the lead, the toys, everything. You sort of go back into the house and they're all there and the animal isn't.
Yeah, I mean, his bed, he had a bed in every room in our house. So the bed...
Humphrey was living high on the hog.
He really was, you know. He had a bed by the back door. I've got these French doors in my office that open out into the garden, and I used to leave them open a lot for him to wander in and out. But his bed is still there, like, you know, 15 years after I put it there and a year after he's gone. He's a bed in our bedroom, which he didn't sleep in the bedroom, but he would, you know, occasionally wander in. And then you try to wake him to put him to bed, and, you know, it was like waking the dead. He would just pretend he was a dead weight to lift and everything, you know. But yeah, it is true, you know, you're left with all of those things and they all have memories attached to them.
How did you decide then to get another dog? Because I found that even though it was probably a year and a bit for me to get a second dog, and I had a sort of a guilt about it.
Yeah. Yeah, and there is definitely that. You get over that, though, I think. Just to have, like, the sound of toys squeaking in the house again, Humphrey's toys squeaking in the house again, was just lovely, you know? And I didn't think I ever would get another dog because, you know, you kind of think I'll never love an animal again the way I loved Humphrey. But and it's true, I won't, but you can love an animal in a different way. And different dogs have different personalities. They make you laugh in different ways. They make you mad in different ways. Bassets are infuriating.
If anyone's, yeah, I'd say Bassets are a handful, aren't they?
Yeah, and I love their personality because they never... I can put my hand on my heart and say Humphrey never did a single thing I ever asked him to do. I remember being in Dunleary once and I'd taken him for a walk and we were getting into the... I was trying to persuade him to get into the car and I was saying to him, Humphrey, please get in. Don't do this to me. I'm begging you, Humphrey. And that's how I spoke to him all the time. But I remember there was a couple putting their incredibly obedient Labrador retriever into the car next to mine. And they were just looking at me like I was insane, like I was a mad person, which I probably was, you know. But that's how I spoke to him. I never spoke sharply to him or shouted at him. I just pleaded with him. And that was kind of our dynamic, really, you know.
Did you ever get him to do a trick of any kind?
No, I mean, he wouldn't even give you the paw. I mean, he ate a lot of treats during the course of trying to teach him the paw trick, but he wouldn't. In fact, if he was about to do something and he picked up on the fact that you wanted him to do it, he would deliberately not do it. So, for instance, he wasn't allowed on the sofa, but he spent most of his life on the sofa because when you told him not, if you said don't get on the sofa, that was just in that moment. And in 5 minutes time, he'd do it again. But I would say to him, that's it, Humphrey, up on the sofa. If he was about to jump up, that's it, up here. And he would stop and he'd look at me and he'd go, No. I'm not doing this because you told me to do it. And he would wait 5 minutes and then get up when it was his idea. It was an extraordinary dynamic we had.
Tech saying, I can relate 100% to Paul. My beloved Shetland Collie Ross died in 2022. I have his ashes on the hearth of the fireplace. I still miss him, still think of him. I love him dearly. 53106 if you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106. You're taking part in the Docky Book Festival, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, I'm doing a Ross event tonight in Fitzpatrick's Castle in Killiney at 9 o'clock. It's called To All the Girls I've Loved Before. So you know how that's going to go.
This is date advice from Ross?
Yeah, it is. It's I decided... I wanted to do a kind of greatest hits thing, you know, because I finished writing the books now and I wanted to do a greatest hits Ross event. And I thought, I was trying to pick a theme and I just thought, what about the 8 lousiest dates he's ever been on in his life? You know, some of them, there are all sorts of things. There's one where he's out on a date with a girl and she turns up on rollerblades. And she gets one of the rollerblades caught in the Lewis line and he has to push her to the top of Harcourt Street. So that's sort of classically a disastrous date that Ross would get involved in.
Have you rethought the financial implications of stopping with these books, Paul?
Well, I mean, it's really interesting to be introduced as a multimillionaire at the start of this item, which will be news to many people, not least my wife. Look, I had a great run writing the Ross O'Carroll Kelly books. I wrote 26 books in 24 years, 28 books in 24 years.
Let me just be clear. That's just 28 of the Ross O'Carroll Kelly. That yeah. doesn't include all of the other books you wrote simultaneously.
Yeah, I was doing other work at the same time because writing Ross 365 days a year would have driven me mad. But, you know, I had a good run. There's no sense in me that I left anything out on the pitch, to use a sporting analogy. Financially, I did incredibly well out of it because it allowed me to it gave me the kind of the freedom to go and do other things that I wanted to do, like the Tara Brown book, for instance, which I spent 10 years on. I couldn't have spent 10 years researching that book if I didn't have an income from writing Ross. So it was very, very good to me. But I'd started to do other things, like I was doing quite a bit of television writing, and I was really enjoying that. And, you know, a Ross book would take maybe 7 months of the year, and I just didn't really have 7 months. And then at the same time, I just had a sense that, from about two or three books back, the story that I was telling through those books, I kind of felt it was coming to an end. I kind of, everyone, the last book, which was Don't Look Back in Anger, which came out a year ago, it really felt like I was kind of moving pieces off the board, moving all the characters into place for the ending.
I still think you should produce book titles, even if you don't do the works.
Oh, really?
The puns were always so good. Of course, the vast wealth from the Rosa Carroll Kelly books did fund your cheese importation business. We were discussing during the break, this is because Miriam Lord, in her column in the Irish Times, actually in reference to our previous guest, Minister for Health Jennifer Carroll McNeill, says that at the Dalkey Book Festival, here's the best bit. This is peak Sandy Cove Glasthoole on the agenda. Gorgonzola cutting by Jennifer Carroll McNeill. Have you ever attended a gorgonzola cutting, Paul?
It's like, you know, an Alan Partridge comes up with all these TV ideas.
You're hustling with
Chris Eubank, monkey tennis, gorgonzola cutting with Jennifer Carroll McNeill. I will be there. I will go along to that. Is that today?
It is, yes.
I'll go along to that, definitely.
Let me tell you exactly what time it is. It's tomorrow. It's
all right.
The 10 a.m. to 10:30, I believe.
Oh, I'm doing an event with Gordon Darcy tomorrow for children, a rugby book event. So it's 11:30.
I'll go along to that.
We will, yeah.
But you were telling me you had to buy in particularly funky cheese from Berlin.
I did, yeah. I wrote a series of books called Aldrin Adams and the Cheese Nightmares. And they were about this kid called Aldrin Adams who, if he ate cheese before he went to bed at night and thought really, really hard about someone, he could get into their nightmares and help deal with the things that frighten them in the night. And as part of the promotion, I used to do readings and things like that. And I thought it'd be fun to get the smelliest cheeses in the world and like triple bag them. There were these Ziploc bags that were triple bagged. And then at the end of the event, pass them around and let the kids smell them. And there's two in particular. One is called Tilsiter. I think it's Belgian. It's German. The other one is called Limburger, which is Belgian. And they are officially the two smelliest cheeses in the world. They are utterly vile. I brought some back from
our apologies to any cheesemakers who may be listening.
I mean, you can't buy them in Ireland or England because I've tried. Like, and I think it's because there's a problem with shipping them. So I was using them for the events and I ran out and I asked my wife's nephew who lives in Berlin to bring us some. And I said, make sure you get it vacuum packed when you're coming home. And he didn't get it vacuum packed. It was in his hand luggage. Put it in the over. And anyway, 10 minutes into the flight, like he said, all he could see was heads turning around. People going, what the hell is that smell? And it was eventually taken from him, actually, on the flight.
Paul, thank you so much. Paul's going to be at the Dalkey Book Festival. You can look it up online.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.